The rainforest was a whole new world. There were lots of different types of tall trees, colourful orchids, thick, dense shrubs, ferns and mosses everywhere.
30 years ago, a nature programme launched on Irish radio.
In a couple of weeks, this pond will be teeming with tadpoles, tens of thousands of tadpoles. I presume that's...
It was different. It wasn't academic and it certainly wasn't dry.
Great to be back, girls. Do you remember I was here maybe some weeks ago when I said I'd come back with the bees? I nearly didn't make it.
No, it was curious and charming and full of surprises.
Through this way, over a little bit. And okay, stop here. Now, turn around, look over there.
Wow.
There she is in all her glory, Derek. That's Zarafa the giraffe. Can you just imagine?
And it had a crown jewel. An annual broadcast like no other in the world.
As dawn breaks and morning light spreads from east to west, we'll be bringing you the breathtaking beauty of birdsong as it moves like a spectacular wave of sound across the face of the earth. So for the next 6 hours, we'll be coming to you live from...
I'm Colm Flynn, and in this special programme on RTE Radio 1, we're marking 3 decades of Mooney Goes Wild, a show that's explored everything from the behaviour of animals to the wonders of ecosystems, biodiversity and the impact of climate change. Each episode has brought us closer to the astonishing diversity of life on this planet. It's a show that has reshaped how we hear, think about and even love the natural world around us. And it all began with this man.
Well, I think it's time for me to get into my wetsuit. While I'm doing that, needless to say, I don't want to expose myself on radio. I don't want to shock you. Richard can take up the chat.
We are at the great shark.
Well, when he wasn't swimming with the great white sharks, chances are you'd find him up a tree with a pair of binoculars.
You can see one of the parents circling about 30, 40 metres above the nest site, and he or she is giving an alarm call.
Yeah, it's the female. She's giving an alarm.
The first programme aired in 1995, created by broadcaster Derek Mooney. Derek Mooney, great to see you.
Colm Flynn.
Let's go back. 1995, you're working here in RTE. Where does the idea come from to start Mooney Goes Wild?
Well, I can tell you, it was born out of necessity. I needed a job. I started working in RTE when I was about 16 on the Los Angeles Olympics. That was in 1984 as a runner. Now, that's a person who's a go for the production crew. Get them tea, get them coffee, get them food, scripts, whatever they need when a program is on air. Skip ahead a few years and I got my first break on telly. And around the same time, a producer named Joe O'Donnell said if I wanted to make it in broadcasting, I needed to find a niche. It didn't matter what the niche was, so long as it was my niche. Step in Don Conroy. Don on the Den, everybody remembers Don. And between the two of us, we came up with an idea for a programme called Habitats, where an expert would take a non-expert, me, into a wildlife habitat and basically give them a pen picture and explain what was going on. That became a radio series, which led on to a programme called The Nature Line, which eventually became Mooney Goes Wild. Now, I had made a pilot programme for radio of Mooney Goes Wild 2 years before it ever saw the light of day. It was hard to convince management that this would actually work on the radio. But I used to say to them, listen, if dancing works on the radio, if Gaelic football works on the radio, why wouldn't nature work on the radio? And eventually they bought into it. But it's important to remember, Colm, that I'm not an expert, but I surrounded myself with people who truly understand the natural world on the shoulders of giants and all that. So my role is the kind of buffer between the science and the listener.
They need one such a fish per osprey per day. So I've seen them take pike, trout, arctic char, flounder, garfish even.
Everything is on the menu.
Everything is on the menu.
And then how do they get that fish back to the nest without, one, it falling out of their grasp, or two, weighing them down? I mean, they have to be pretty precise about what size of fish they're going for. Or do they? Is it just potluck?
No, well, yes, they'll catch anything. Once they've caught a fish, it's quite interesting to see. Ospreys are zygodactylo, which means that they have a reversible outer toe. And they will turn the fish head first into the direction they fly. It's the most aerodynamical way of transporting a fish.
That was Derek in action there, marvelling at the extraordinary hunting skills of an osprey, also known as a seahawk, as it snatches dinner from the water. We'll hear more from Derek later about how Moonee Goes Wild evolved into Ireland's biggest nature programme, culminating in its most beloved event, the Dawn Chorus. But before that, let's meet the show's secret weapon, its experts. Because over the years, the programme has featured some of the most brilliant minds in the field, but a few voices have been with it since the very beginning.
The edge of the forest consisted of high trees with an evergreen canopy forming a green wall. And from here, it didn't seem to be raining. But when I got inside, oh boy.
That unmistakable voice belongs to biologist Aina Nilauna, one of the first to join Derek on the show after he discovered her in a little book.
I got involved right back at the beginning because my name was in a book. And the book is called, and I have it here with me, it's called The Director of Women Contributors to Radio and Television. And this book was produced in 1990 to give guidance to producers in RTE of women who could do things. Now, there was no need for a book for men. Of course, men can do everything. But they had a book of women who could do things.
And that's the book you're holding in your hand right
yeah,
there?
That's the directory of RTE.
The Director of Women
yes,
Contributors.
Yes, and on page 85, there is Nilauna Aina.
You have to remember that up until this time, wildlife on the radio was handled in a very academic way. Usually, one expert talking to another, never leaving the studio. It was often inaccessible and sometimes quite boring. Aina loved that this show was different. It was interactive and it brought listeners right into the story.
And it worked. It was great. It was the first time ever that wildlife was made interesting for people who wanted to know, I saw that thing walking up the wall. What is it? And what will it do to you? I saw that thing on the floor. How do you get rid of it? I mean, wildlife was the enemy. And now you had someone that would actually tell you about it. So it was a great success from the very beginning.
One of Aina's fondest memories is from 2004, when she travelled to Costa Rica and took listeners deep into the country's hot, humid rainforest to investigate the mystery of walking trees.
Are these the roots of that tree?
Those are the roots of that tree. That's what we call a walking palm.
And a walking palm?
Walking palm because it was studied in South America and they found out that the palm is able to walk, to move from one place to another as it grows up to find more light.
So it pulls up its roots and it walks over there and it puts them down again. Come on.
No, not that way. But they start off with only two roots and then they grow more and more roots that come out of the trunk and go into the ground.
The birds have bright, colourful feathers, royal blue, violet, emerald green, orange, and indeed their names are as colourful as their plumage. The resplendent Quetzal, the long-tailed manakin, and the black-faced solitaire. Certainly when it comes to dressing up and advertising your wares, you cannot beat the birds of the rainforests.
And from the rainforests of Costa Rica to the rocky shores of Malahide in Dublin. Look at this, we're sitting in Malahide looking out at this beautiful view. Tell us what we can see in front of us here.
Well, this is the coastline between Port Mayrannock and Malahide. Rocks down there are around 350 million years old, which is very interesting. They're limestone rocks.
That's Dr. Richard Collins, a former engineer turned zoologist.
By training, I was an engineer. I spent 40 years working as an electrical engineer. And coming up to retirement, I felt I had some energy left, you see, and that it would be, which I mustn't waste energy, you know, that's what. So I decided I would do something different. So I actually began studying swans, of all things.
Before joining the show, Richard was tracking how far Irish swans were migrating by placing coated rings around their legs.
You can track swans, you can see them. And at that time, we didn't think they went very far. So I thought, well, I could use this as a test base. I started catching the swans, and I ended up with 1,500 swans ringed on the box.
Quite dangerous, isn't it? Because we know swans can be violent and they can be quite strong as well.
Well, they don't suffer fools gladly, but they're not dangerous. Well, I shouldn't say that, because one of the protections they have is their reputation.
Yes.
So I don't want to damage their reputation as fearsome beasts. Oh, I did get injured once. I went into the Meath Hospital with damaged ribs as a result of a fracas with this one. I remember the doctor in there saying, "How did you get these injuries?" And I said, "Well, I had an altercation with the swan." And he wanted to send me to some other branch at the hospital. Yes. I forget what it was called.
Hey, yo-yo! Boop, boop.
An extraordinary experiment is taking place in the United States. Yo-yo is a trumpeter swan, and Professor Bill Sladen is teaching trumpeters how to migrate.
That's very nice. Now, they're coming along nicely.
They'll come down, but we just have to give them time. Come on, yo-yo!
The trumpeter is the world's largest swan, and it's the world's heaviest flying animal.
That's a wonderful display. That's a water-treading display, but the male will do that with much more sound. You'll hear him. And you see him in threat. Now look.
Oh, beautiful.
Isn't that lovely?
Isn't that gorgeous?
They create a smoke screen because we have snapping turtles here. Come on, Yo-Yo. Come on out and visit us.
3 decades, 30 years on the air with Derek and talking about the natural world around you. What are kind of some of the standout moments when you think back?
Oh, dear, there were so many. There were so many.
And what was one of his standout moments? Diving with Derek among great white sharks off the coast of South Africa.
Of course, we are at the great shark-watching mecca of the world, I suppose, here. This is probably the best place to go.
Derek and I went to see the great white sharks in the cages, you know.
Did you go down in the cages?
Yes, we did, yeah. And it was quite something. I mean, these extraordinary beasts, they're right in front of you in this cage, you know, and you... the temptation to stretch your hand out and stroke the beast, you know.
So if he gets a nice fat seal to eat, does he need to eat again? Or when would he need to eat again?
Well, great white sharks are predatory, opportunistic feeders. They're continuously on the lookout for their next meal. They have been known not to eat for months at a time if there is no source of food around. At the same token, when there is ample food around, they gorge themselves, and they will eat and eat and eat hundreds of kilograms until they can't eat no more.
And as you can hear, while Richard kept us cool, well, let's just say Derek wasn't so calm.
Okay, am I going to get in the water? I might as well just do it.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Okay, so we've got
a lovely big shark here. We've got nice clear water.
Oh, my God. Oh. Oh. The shark just... The shark...
Down. Put yourself down. Rusty.
The shark, first time around, the shark leapt out of the water to grab the bait. And then the second time it was going around the boat. So I got a fright when it came out so close to the cage. And the second time I tried to get myself under and remember to hold on with both hands. It's very scary indeed. But at the same time, it's very interesting, Martin, I have to say. It's extraordinary stuff.
Oh, it's amazing. Derek, was there a point when you realised, this is working, there's something to this?
Yeah, it was on Saturday mornings at the beginning, and we were only scheduled in for a short run, but the appetite for the material that we were putting out on air was so large, and it was obvious because the phones never stopped ringing. From the moment the red light went on, people were calling in, and we were receiving about 300 calls or more when we were on air for that hour. I mean, that's a huge volume of traffic to a radio programme. And after the first year, we were in the top 10 most listened to radio programmes in the country. Let's get on with the programme. And we start with a voice message from Roland, who was out for a walk in Merrion Square Park recently when he noticed something.
Hello, Mooney Goose Wild. I have a question for you.
And my name is Dave Callahan. I'm here in Red Hills,
just outside of Kildare Town, County Kildare, and this is what I'm hearing.
Good morning, Dawn Chorus listeners. My name is Sheena Cahill, Longford woman displaced to the Liberties. It is now just gone 5 a.m.
And Paddy got in touch, he's in Portadown in County Armagh. He sent in a video. Now, the video shows a rook in the garden trying to get at the nuts in a hanging feeder.
Hello, Derek. I have been feeding birds for a long time, mainly aimed at small birds like finches. But a few rooks have started coming to feed as well. I sent you a little video recently there. It shows a rook trying to get food from a little bird feeder. Now, normally the rook would jump up, grab hold of the metal pole that is supporting the feeder, and try and reach across and get a few seeds, but it's very awkward for them. But one of the rooks looked hard at the feeder. He then jumped onto the edge of a half-barrel plant holder, and he was able to reach across and grab with the tip of his beak the end of one of the little perches on the feeder. He would pull it back towards himself, release it. The feeder would swing away and come back like a pendulum, and on the return, the rook would beak into the food port and get a couple of seeds. And he would repeat the process, grab the perch, pull it, release it, and on the return swing, dip in and get a seed.
It really is amazing, isn't it, just how intelligent rooks are, like their fellow members of the crow family. They really are brainy. It's showing an understanding of physics.
Corvid intelligence there at its best. Well, from rooks to frogs, and spring was always a busy season for the team.
Now, at the top of the programme, Terry, Richard was saying that he knew it was spring because he heard the skylark singing outside his home. And you can say something similar in relation to this week's report.
Yes, it's true, Derek, what Richard says about noticing things in springtime. One of the great joys of spring for me is to see the frogs come out of hibernation.
That's the voice of Terry Flanagan, a teacher who brought his classroom passion for nature to the airwaves.
This is incredible, not only to watch it, but also to listen to it.
I was a teacher for over 40 years, 43 years. I started teaching in the late 1970s and I retired a couple of years ago. I taught science, I taught biology, always interested in nature and wildlife. So it was really just a progression to go from there to join some wildlife organisations, which I did, and then also to move into local radio, which I did as well. And Derek said to me, why don't you just come in and do that kind of stuff with me?
Now, Terry, mind your step. It's after being very wet here the last few days in County Kildare.
It certainly has, and you've brought me up to your pond, your man-made pond here, and looking into it, I can see tons and tons of frog spawn and also plenty of action from adult frogs.
Yes, they started spawning 3 or 4 days ago now, and there's been non-stop action ever since.
You can hear it as well here. We're hearing it in the background, that low level. It's very hard to define what it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's constant from morning till night.
Terry travelled all over the country with his recorder. If you had a question, an observation, or a curious tale to tell, well, Terry wanted to hear it.
Tell us what happens. That's really what I want to know.
I always said that, and I still say, that I have the best job on Mooney Goes Wild because I'm the reporter. I'm the one that gets out every single week, all over the country and sometimes abroad, to look at unusual stories. Only recently I was down watching frogs mating down in County Kildare with a man called Dermot Dorn, who's a farmer who has put in a pond, and every year hundreds of frogs come and you get this orgy of mating of frogs in February, and it's incredible, and the sound is great as well.
Kestrel are eating a lot of frogs. One time there I was curious, I could see numerous times coming down and plucking the frogs out of the pond
while they were mating.
Correct, yes.
So their minds were elsewhere, they weren't paying attention to anything apart from the mating game.
Yes, they were very focused on the mating game, and maybe some of them would have been better off probably just having a good look around to see, yeah, was there any predators there.
Keep an eye open.
Correct, correct.
Then there was Philip McCabe, the programme's B-man. He was the president of the International Federation of Beekeepers Associations, if you don't mind.
Nice early start for you, Philip.
Oh, what do you mean, ah, nice early start for me? The day's half over there, I guess. It's probably the same for you.
Why are you wearing the white suit?
Well, I have here an observation hive with about, say, 5,000 bees in it. I put them into it last night. I marked the queen. But when I'm travelling with the bees, no matter where I'm going, I'm in the suit. Mm. There's always the possibility, if I had a hive in the back of the Jeep or travelling somewhere, and for some reason it shunted or I put my foot in the brake or something moved, if the hive jarred, the bees might get out. Something might happen. I'm just trying to foresee what could possibly happen.
Philip McCabe was the bee man with us. Sadly, Philip has passed away. I remember once, and I remember the date exactly because it was my birthday. It was the 25th of June. It was back in 2005. And Philip was going for a world record.
He's stripping off. He's stripping down to his underpants. Well, Philip is going to try and set a world record. They're going to pour 500,000 bees onto me in either four.
And what he had decided to do was to place a queen bee on his body, stripped off. He's only in his underpants. This is down in the field in Tipperary. And what they do is they wanted all the female bees to come and to land on his body.
He's hoping to get 100 pounds weight of bees attached onto his chin, and he's had to wear the back brace because he just worries because of the weight that will be, he'll be leaning forward because of this. So the world record is 87.5 pounds. He's confident that he's going to hit it.
Philip is no longer with us, but his memory lives on. And aside from the well-established panel of experts, the programme has grown over the years to include an extended family of contributors, like Ken Whelan, a fishery scientist who once brought listeners to one of the most remote corners of Greenland.
As it is at the moment, there are no roads into where I am. So if I don't come back, Derek, you won't be able to come and find me by road. You'd have to either get a boat or you'd fly in by helicopter. But that's the only way to get here. And that's the beauty of being in Cockertuck. It is just surrounded by what looks like huge Arctic tundra. So there's lots and lots of bare rock because we're right beside the ocean. And just behind us then, we have the huge ice cap, the big Greenlandic ice cap. We can't actually see it from where we are, but we flew right over it from Narsasawak when I came in on Tuesday. And that's a really, really spectacular thing to see. In a lot of Greenland, it is extremely cold. But in this area here, it does get a much warmer climate in the winter, relatively speaking. So the actual bays or fjords that are here stay free. But they get a lot of visiting polar bears here. I was talking about the polar bears to them yesterday. But interestingly, the area that I'm in is not that terribly far from the Northwest Passage. And we were looking at very large concentrations of jellyfish yesterday. And I had read in recent times that there are quite a lot of jellyfish now of species that are from the Pacific starting to appear in this particular area. And we may very well see very big changes if the ice doesn't fully form over that Northwest Passage into the future.
Well, from the freezing glaciers of Greenland back home to the Emerald Isle, another friend of the programme is Eric Dempsey, a dedicated bird watcher whose enthusiasm is as boundless as his energy.
What I'm going to be doing, Derek, is I'm going to be talking about my passion. Mm. Right, now this is going to sound mad because, you know, I'm the bird man. And of course, what makes a bird a bird? You know, and I often ask that. I do a lot of talks with kids and various things, and I always ask that question, what makes a bird? And most people say, well, they fly. And you're right, yeah, birds have
they
wings.
They do fly.
They do fly, but of course not all birds fly.
Eric's what you'd call a twitcher. That's someone who'll go to extraordinary lengths to catch a glimpse of a rare bird, no matter the distance or the weather. But it's not just the thrill of the chase that draws him in, it's the details. And in this clip, he turns his attention to something about birds that is often overlooked.
What makes birds special are feathers. Nothing else in the entire planet has feathers except birds. Feathers allow birds to do so many things. They've allowed birds to fly. They've allowed birds like penguins, emperor penguins, to survive down in the Antarctic. They allow birds to dive under the water. They allow birds to fly at great heights like barheaded geese, which fly over Everest. They allow birds to migrate. They are incredible evolutionary things, feathers. Feathers are what makes a bird a bird.
In fact, Eric is so passionate about feathers and he's so much to say about them, once he set up a home cinema and made Derek sit down on his own, pay attention and listen carefully to his presentation.
Right, so are you comfortable there, Derek?
I am very comfortable, okay, thank you, Eric, yes.
Now, before we start, always rules like every cinema and every slideshow, turn off your mobile phone.
It's off.
Okay. No chatting.
Okay, yes.
No scratching.
Scratching.
Yeah, no scratching and no smooching.
Who would I be smooching?
I don't know, but I just have to make sure that there's no smooching. Oh, right. Okay, right. Anyway, Derek, this is a talk that I give, and I've given it from junior infants to adults to clubs to societies, everywhere, all over the place. And it sort of looks at what birds achieve because they have feathers, what they're able to do. And first one I'm going to ask you is, do you know what bird that might be?
It looks like a swallow from the outline.
Exactly. It is a swallow. We know it's a swallow because it has that big, long, forked tail.
And the tail streamers.
Tail streamers. You see, those tail streamers, they're just feathers. But without those, the bird, like a swallow, would not be able to manoeuvre as well as it does to catch insects. Those tail streamers give that bird the agility in the air. And, you know, I always talk about what swallows are. This is a beautiful little swallow sitting on a perch, a little red face and blue back. You know, a swallow is only the size of your hand and he weighs 18 grams. And to get an idea what 18 grams is, the swallow is half the weight of a bag of potato crisps. And they have a little brain the size of a pea. And those long wings that you see in a swallow are the classic long wings of a long-distant migrant.
What made Mooney Goes Wild truly special wasn't just what they did, but it was the way they did it. It was the way they explored their subjects with humour and honesty.
I interviewed an expert about grey wagtails one time, which looked very yellow to me, and I said to him, why is it called a grey wagtail? And he was absolutely in shock when he said to me, because it's grey and wags its tail. And one of the Sunday newspapers absolutely went to town on me.
You're listening to a special programme celebrating 30 years of Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio 1. I'm Colm Flynn, speaking with the people that shaped the show and have played a huge part in raising awareness of Ireland's wildlife for three decades. And while there have been countless memorable moments over the years, one annual event stands out like no other, the Dawn Chorus.
As dawn breaks and morning light spreads from east to west, we'll be bringing you the breathtaking beauty of birdsong as it moves like a spectacular wave of sound across the face of the earth. So for the next 6 hours, we'll be coming to you live from Cuscany Marsh Nature Reserve here in Cove in County Cork on the south coast of Ireland. So please allow us to be your travel companions as we embark on this unique journey together, navigating our way right across the continent, allowing nature to be our guide.
The Dawn Chorus has become a radio tradition in Ireland, celebrating nature's most beautiful alarm clock. The show runs from midnight until 6 or 7 a.m. on the first Sunday of May, in sync with International Dawn Chorus Day. Derek, who did you have to convince to allow you to do a live, uninterrupted, six-hour broadcast here on Radio 1?
Well, at the time, it was the director of radio, because if you think back to the late 90s and early noughties, telethons were all the rage. And I thought we could do a radiothon. But instead of raising money, we would raise awareness of the natural world. And what better way to showcase this than by broadcasting the sound of early morning birdsong, the Dawn Chorus? And much to my surprise, she said, yes, go ahead, do it. And I thought, oh, so now I had a problem. I have to fill 6 hours of live radio, but I've no location. What am I going to do? But then I thought I'd contact Jim Wilson. He was our man in Cove, a great ornithologist. And I said to him, Jim, here's my situation. Have you got a location? I'm joined here by ornithologist Jim Wilson.
Good morning, Derek, and it's a fantastic morning.
Now, when the Dawn Chorus kicks off, there's literally hundreds of thousands, millions of birds singing. And unless you have a finely tuned ear, it's very hard to distinguish one from the other. So our idea was to go on air at midnight until 6 a.m., 6 hours live, hence the idea of a radiothon, but be there when the first bird sings and tell people a little bit about that and then try and explain the others as they
come into play. You know, the bird with the big eye usually is the one that wakes up first. The early bird catches the worm. So myself, Aine Launa, Richard Collins and June Wilson set up base at Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove.
Richard Collins, your thoughts?
I believe hearing our dawn chorus is one of the great wildlife experiences. And I happen to think that the one we have in Ireland is better than those anywhere else. We have something to really boast about, a wildlife experience second to none, the dawn chorus of Europe.
Well, thank you, Richard. And for the very first time in the history of the Mooney Goes Wild programme, millions of listeners right across Europe.
When the morning breaks and the light comes flooding down on all our lives and the air is singing, who sings the stars down from the darkness? Who sings the sun up into the morning? Who cracks open the dawn? Us, us, sing the blackbird and the thrush. Us, us, sing the red-breast robin. And us, us, sings the band of wrens singing in the fresh green branches. All join the dawn chorus.
One of the key contributors to the dawn chorus is ornithologist Jim Wilson, who, right now, is standing in Kuskany Marsh in County Cork. Jim, why did you pick that location?
Well, Cullum, we were able to get the sounds of what I would consider Ireland's main habitat types. We had a lagoon, we had fresh water, we had deciduous woodland, we had coniferous woodland, we had farmland, lots of habitats within a very short distance, which meant we could put microphones out from the broadcast unit quite easily and be able to listen in on the various participants from the various habitats within a very short area of the broadcast unit. And here we are now, and it's still going strong, and we're broadcasting not only to the people of Ireland, but to the whole world. And it's great to have been a part of it, and it's great to be a part of it. And I'm sure it's something that will carry on for as long as the birds will sing.
At the dawn chorus, Derek, when you're sitting in the woodland, you can hear the birds start to sing around you, and you know that this is going out wirelessly across the country on the radio.
Across the whole world. It's going out not just on radio, but the World Wide Web. So we're literally transmitting to the whole world.
Is that a magical feeling?
It is, but it's also nerve-wracking. I don't think people realise how much effort goes into making any radio programme, let alone a live 6 or 7 hour broadcast outdoors. I mean, we're not inside. We have no cover. Anything could go wrong. The power could go. Lightning could strike. The birds may not sing. And in fact, one year, I actually cried during the broadcast, not because of the emotion of what we were doing, but because it had rained so heavily the previous 2 days. And then from the moment we went on air all the way through our actual live broadcast, that I was convinced the birds were not going to sing. But not only did they sing, the cuckoo sang. Now, we'd heard the cuckoo previously, but not every year. But luckily for us, our researcher, Katrina McFadden, was in Donegal, in Glenveagh National Park, and she captured the most spellbinding sound of the cuckoo singing in the rain. And the icing on the cake for me, after all that pressure, was an email from an Irish guy who was living in New York, in the Big Apple, listening live on the internet, and he said that it reminded him of home. The cuckoo and the rain.
Right, Derek, just follow me through here. Put this down here now. Very weighty tome, isn't it?
He is.
Don't worry, there's
making
no exam.
Me nervous.
No, there's no exam. I won't be testing at the end of it.
Another well-known voice of the dawn chorus is Niall Hatch, Head of Communications and Development at Birdwatch Ireland.
We just flick through here to page 238, I think it is. Yep. Okay.
And I visited him at their headquarters. Niall Hatch, it's great to be sitting with you here in Birdwatch Ireland over a cup of tea as well.
Yeah, very civilised, isn't it? So we're here in Birdwatch Ireland's library. Look at all these books around us here.
Wow.
Yeah, it's plenty here. I could spend many, many hours in here reading all this.
Now, Niall, what are you doing here? Because by training, am I right or wrong that you're a corporate lawyer?
That's right. I qualified as a solicitor after doing various law degrees, and I worked in the corporate world for a while.
my first love has always been birds, ever since I was a small, small child.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. You know, they say, when did you know? When did you know that you just had this love and passion for birds and for wildlife?
I don't remember, because it predates my conscious memory. My mother tells me that she used to take me to St. Stephen's Green to feed the ducks there, like most kids do, or many kids do. But unlike them, I wasn't just content to throw the bread to them. I wanted to get out of my little pushchair and go over and have conversations with them and be chatting away and baby talk to the ducks. I just found them fascinating, apparently. And I remember as a kid being fascinated with a robin in the back garden before I could even properly speak. I think I was just waddling around the place. I do remember that. And I've never known a time when I wasn't fascinated by birds, and it stayed with me all my life.
Isn't that a beautiful thing? You were looking at the critters around you and saying, who are these creatures? Where did they come from? How many types are there? What shapes and sizes and colours? And
why is it doing that? Like, what's making it do that? And why does that one do that, but this one doesn't? And just that curiosity, I think. And maybe that's what led me to the law as well, because a lot of that is working out problems and curiosity. I always had a curious mind like that.
How much for a ticket to the Westman Islands, please?
It's 2,400 just the one way, so 4,800 for both ways.
How long does the journey take?
It takes around 40 minutes.
That's great. I'll take a return ticket, please.
All right. I just need your ID to put your name on the booking.
It was great to have a dedicated program on the radio like that, all about wildlife, at a time when people weren't talking about it. I think it really put it on the agenda. And as someone who was always interested in wildlife, I was an avid listener to it. So when I got the opportunity through Birdwatch Ireland to be interviewed on the program and to talk about it and to get to know Derek and the team, I really, really liked it. I never thought that I was the kind of person who would have the confidence to speak on the radio or to talk about anything. I thought I'd be tongue-tied. I thought I'd be very nervous. But actually, when it came to something that I was passionate about, birds and conservation and saving wildlife, I realised that I could do it. Iceland is the puffin-watching capital of the world, home to 60% of the planet's Atlantic puffin population.
Did you notice over the years that there was a heightened awareness of the bird life around us, let's say, because of the show, as a direct result of the programme?
Yes, without doubt. And I think that there's been certain things that we've noticed with that. I remember where I first saw the upswing was when there was a major outbreak of bird flu, probably about 15 years ago or so, maybe a bit longer. We were speaking on Mooney Goes Wild about it. And because of that, other things like the RT News would talk to myself and a couple of my colleagues about this as well. And it really got the word out there. People started to know us. We were on the radio a lot. And people really started to know that and react to it. And that interest has continued. And it's always sort of been there bubbling away in the background. What's really spurred it again was COVID. The thing was, during COVID, Mooney Goes Wild managed to keep broadcasting programs every week in a time where we were all doing it from home. And I think a lot of people were then starting to see nature through new eyes. It became like a salvation for them. People think back to that time, there was no traffic. There were no airplanes. It was deathly quiet, and people were hearing the birds. I think what it was as well, people were seeing the birds coming back and forth with their little twigs and feathers, building their nests, and life for them was going on. They weren't aware of the problems that we humans were going through globally. And I think it actually was a very strong sort of symbol for people that actually life continues and it's resilient and we will get out of this. And I think that that was very important. That's a message that we carried across on the radio as well.
And perhaps it was a time when people, because of the slowdown, the global slowdown, were forced to kind of take a step back, and then they notice things in their garden that maybe just because life is so fast that they had never even noticed before. That bird, that sound, that bird song they had never heard.
Oh, absolutely. And that interest, while it was a peak, all right, that interest has maintained more or less. We also saw a huge increase in membership of Birdwatch Ireland, which for a charity relies on that as our lifeblood to conserve and to educate and do all of that. We really rely on that, and support is very much appreciated. And Derek has been really good to Birdwatch Ireland and other NGOs in allowing us to have that voice and also to try and get support from the public.
Any standout moments, Niall, in your mind's eye, when you think back of the two decades you've been involved in the programme, where you think, oh, that was a beautiful moment?
There's a couple of them, and obviously being a bird obsessive, a lot of them do relate to birds. I absolutely love the Dawn Chorus every year. It's one of my favourite things, and I've been so lucky to be involved with that, co-hosting it down from Kilskenny Marsh, talking to Derek and to Jim Wilson, other experts all about this. That's absolutely amazing to hear that bird song. I particularly remember the first international one we had, where we had All India Radio on it, and we had people from all over the planet participating. It was just this huge radio event with millions and millions of listeners globally. It must be one of the biggest programs that RT has ever been responsible for. I think that's overshadowed. I think people don't talk about that enough, actually, how pioneering that was.
The Mooney Goes Wild International Dawn Chorus in 2016 was a unique global event. As the sun rose, broadcasters around the world, including Radio Vara in the Netherlands and All India Radio, with a listenership estimated in the hundreds of millions, captured the sound of birds waking up in real time, offering listeners a journey through nature's symphony, a celebration of wildlife, of sound and global connection, one sunrise at a time.
Morning, Derek. Thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to join the Dawn Chorus this time from the easternmost location I think you have in this broadcast. The Dawn Chorus here is in full swing. We've been waiting here for some time. The sun has not yet risen. It's going to rise at 5:35 local time. That's in another 15 minutes or so. But the sky has lightened, and we really have the entire gamut of species over here joining into the Dawn Chorus.
And battalions of crows and mynas, which are the Indian starlings, and they are now moving across the lightning sky, and this tremendous background sound that you hear are the mynas now waking up and moving out to their feeding grounds.
Hi, Derek, how are you?
Very good this morning.
Very nice night here in the Biesbos. I'm here with forester Theo Muse, and we're actually very close to a blue throat singing on one end of the little alley that we're standing on. And on the other end, we hear two nightingales, Theo.
Yes, two nightingales, and there's a set swarbler as well, fully committing itself. So it's already started here.
Probably partly because it's such a clear sky. The moon is yes, very bright. So the birds must think it's almost morning already.
The live broadcast of the Dawn Chorus is nothing short of magical. It showcases Mooney Goes Wild at its very best. With Derek at the helm as the presenter, but also the producer, the programme has earned a long list of awards over the years. Amongst the highlights, winning the prestigious Prix Europa in 2000 for its groundbreaking coverage of nesting jackdaws in a disused chimney in County Kildare.
This is the M7 near Naas in County Kildare. It's the busiest motorway in Ireland. Almost 70,000 cars pass this way every day. And behind me is the site of the old Leinster flour mills. It was here in May and June that the eyes and ears of the nation were focused on the fortunes of a pair of nesting jackdaws, Jackie and Daw, as they raised their first brood of the millennium.
And the coveted Rose Door for the incredible innovation behind the live broadcast of the Dawn Chorus.
The extremely worthy winner for the 2016 Rose Door Radio Event of the Year goes to the European Dawn Chorus, RTE Radio 1 from Ireland.
It's a great reminder of how powerful radio can be when it connects people to the world around them.
Definitely my standout, if I had to pick one memory particularly that is most precious to me about Mooney Goes Wild, it was related to the Dawn Chorus when I had the great fortune, I think it was 2016, I was sent to Norway, and I was with a wonderful gentleman from the Norwegian state broadcaster, NRK, his name's Helge Softeland, and we went into this special tent that was set up so we could watch the lekking behaviour, which means the mating behaviour, the males sort of facing off against each other, of a wonderful bird called the capercaillie, which is a big member of the grouse family. It's like a giant turkey, almost all black turkey. We used to have them in Ireland centuries ago. They became extinct here. And just to be there watching this bird, it was something that was an experience money couldn't buy.
That's actually the alpha male charging rival slightly away from us to the west here now. It chased him down.
They're so aggressive. And oh,
this
female,
one, this female, one, female.
And male in hot pursuit behind her.
Playing up rather nicely in front of the microphone.
The male is chasing her, 3 or 4 meters behind her, dragging his wings, strutting his tail. And now he veered off to the left.
We were there in this freezing tent in the snow. They do this at dawn, but they're very sensitive to humans. So we had to be in this tent before sunset the previous evening. And so we're there. And of course, it's, you're very far north, and it's in the summertime. So it was, you know, we're there from very early. There's no opportunity to go out and use the facilities or anything like that. You cannot leave, and the birds will be freaked out, and they will leave, and it could be disastrous for their breeding. So we were in this tent for like 18 hours. And we were there, and I never forget it. The next morning, they put on this amazing display, and we were looking out. And the amazing thing was, they don't know what a human voice is. We're talking quite loudly for the radio broadcast, and they didn't care. But if they got sight of a human, they would flee, and it would be a disaster. And to see these huge male birds just ripping each other's feathers out and fighting, it was incredible.
There's another female flying in. He's actually chasing the other female into the lake.
It's kicking off, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh,
look at that. Just a quick smash of the wings, throwing some snow up into the air and just herding us.
He's just showing his dominance. He's saying, this is my patch. I want all these females. Everyone else get lost.
And if you could have a medical team standing at the ready, because if this gets any more exciting, Myle Hatch's eyes are going to pop out of his head.
All the snow around us was just covered in blood. They'd just been really, I had never realised just how violent the whole thing was. They were actually ripping strips out of each other. And all the time they're doing this, the females are sitting around in the trees watching them and trying to pick which male is the best, who's the strongest, who's the bravest. It was really, really fascinating to do it. I think it made for great radio as well.
Blackbird sing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
One of the show's greatest charms is Derek's ability to make nature feel fresh and fun. It never felt like just another wildlife programme. A bit like the time when Sir David Attenborough dropped by to talk about his BBC series Planet Earth, but instead ended up reminiscing about his childhood and collecting animals' teeth.
Blackbird in the dead of night.
And there were sharks' teeth too. I mean, they were very rare, I have to say. And I only found little bits of those as a boy. But by golly, they were treasures, you know. I had an ichthyosaur vertebra, a thoracic vertebra. Oh, I can imagine.
I was going to ask you, did you have many friends when you were growing up? Because geology was a big thing when you were a kid, for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I suppose... I don't know, looking back, one looks back, maybe people have said to me, oh, you're a nasty, solitary little boy going around the countryside on your bicycle picking up bits of rock. Maybe I was. I don't know. I wasn't all that kind of, misanthropic. But no, I certainly did spend a lot of time cycling around the countryside looking at rocks. And looking at fossils, and of course it's a very interesting thing to do. It teaches you an awful lot about the natural world, really, about the classification, and I'm very, very sorry these days that so many kids, you know, we've made it, I know it's essential, but we have made it against the law for kids to pick up bits and pieces. You can't take a bird's egg now, and you can't pluck a flower, and you, even if you picked up a feather, it's technically against the law. And that's the whole business of collecting is one of the basis of what makes naturalists and scientists, in my view.
Do you think it's okay to take a bird's egg from a nest?
Well, I think, of course, for one boy to do it once is fine. Whether it's for a million boys, doing it a million times is a different question.
You were only waiting for this moment to be free, blackbird. Fly, into the light of the dark night.
30 years on, Mooney Goes Wild has become much more than a radio show. It's a lifeline, a connection to nature, to the wild, and to the wonders of the world around us.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
What's next on the programme? What would you like to tackle next? What would you like to talk about? Where would you like to go? What would you like to explore on Mooney Goes Wild?
Well, the sky's the limit, because the thing that I think is most remarkable about Mooney Goes Wild, it's been going weekly for 30 years, and we never run out of things to talk about. And we never will. you know, we have to drop things from the program all the time. There's too much stuff. So wildlife never ceases to provide plenty of great content.
The actual emphasis of the program has changed over the 30 years. So it's kind of a more worthy program now, if you like, because there were people who wouldn't come on our program at the beginning because it was just a red top, you know, but making people laugh about wildlife, which was a very serious topic. But we don't get so many refusals now for people to come on the radio. They're all delighted to come on our program now because obviously in 30 years we've earned our stripes.
You've earned the stripes, that's great.
The colours of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
And it's so unjust, it's so wrong. So here's what my third-rate feeble brain, the secretions of that brain, are being sent out to such an enormous audience. I mean, it's wrong, it's just sheer. I mean, it's
I love you, I hear babies cry.
People still love the Mooney Goes Wild programme. And I love it when people come back to you and say, oh, heard you on the radio. I really never knew that. Yeah. That's something I learned. It's things like that. That's what makes it all worthwhile.
And I think to myself...
Derek, as we're about to wrap up this show, looking back at 30 years of Mooney Goes Wild, how do you explain its success and how it seemed to have captivated the public?
Honestly, because it's not boring. A couple of weeks ago, we got a call from a guy called Tamo. He's a barber in Coolmine in Dublin 15. Terry went up to investigate this. He told us that a robin had come into the barber shop and built a nest on a shelf in front of his workstation, laid eggs, and now the eggs had hatched. There were four chicks flying around the barber shop, and the male and female were coming in and feeding the chicks while the customers were getting a short back inside. I mean... what's not to like about that?
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That programme was presented by Colm Flynn. The producer was Derek Mooney.